Live from Lead Feather Studios, it's the most controversial film podcast on the air. I don't give a flick.
Hey, everybody, welcome to another episode of I Don't Give a Flick. Once again, I am Johnny Blackburn. Alongside me this week, as they are every week, because I can't seem to shake them, I've got
Gary Elmore
and Neil Riley.
And this week we are more than privileged and pleased to have with us filmmakers from around the country. We've got with us Austin-based filmmaker Polaris Banks. Polaris, welcome to the show. So happy to have you.
Hey, hi to all three of you.
And we've also got another local Austin filmmaker, Neil McKay. Neil, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And we've got one of only two people not in the state of Texas. We got my friend out in Chicago, local based filmmaker Matt Strand Jordan. Matt, so happy to have you again on your second episode at this point.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, guys. I thought you wouldn't invite me back, but here we are.
We are desperate for people. Welcome
slow
back.
Slow week.
It's a slow week. Yeah. Normally they don't have me hosting. It's usually Rupert Murdoch, but we said fuck him and we'll get Johnny back. So for this week, we're going to be diving into a look at indie filmmaking and the process that indie filmmakers go through trying to create their passions, their masterpieces, their magnum opus, if you will. Hopefully for everybody, it's their magnum opus. So we'll take a look tonight at not only some of the most underrated and greatest indie films of all time, or at least the opinions of the table on said movies, but we're going to take a look at how you finance a film, how you go through the process of writing it, and how you go through the process of casting and crewing it as well, and then getting it out to distributors and festivals alike. So we got a nice episode here for you with a lot of really good insight from these three filmmakers here. So let's jump into it right now. I do want to give a brief introduction to all three of you guys, so our audience knows who you are. If you're familiar with our politics and film episode, we had Matt on there already, and so you're kind of familiar with him, but that was in season one. So Polaris, I want to start out with you. If you just want to give kind of a brief intro about yourself, how you got into filmmaking, what you've been doing over the last year or couple years, what you got coming up, stuff like that.
Okay. Right now I'm in during my festival run, so I worked for like five freaking years on a one movie. So I had practiced a lot in my early 20s and made movie after movie after movie. And when one finally turned out good, then I went, oh, I wish I had spent a little more on this and tried a little harder. And then I went all out and I just started saving up as much as I can and picking at it and working. And it took years and years. And we just premiered it. It's called Rec Law this year at South by Southwest. And then we did Fantasia and a few other festivals. And then recently it was at Holly Shorts and it won Best Thriller, which is great.
Yeah, baby.
And now I'm into the horror festivals because it's October. So now I'm in like Mile High Horror Fest and Horror Fest International and Film Quest and Nightmares. And also, and then one non-horror festival, this Newport Beach. So it's very busy for me. I'm just emailing a bunch of people who are mad at me because I haven't gotten back to them with my festival materials that I'm supposed to do. That's it for now. I'll tell you more about the kooky shit later.
Absolutely, man. Absolutely. How did you get into filmmaking originally? Kind of what was the thing that inspired you? Was it from a young age? Did you fall into it? What was your process?
I never wanted to do anything else. I liked, Indiana Jones movies and, Spielberg stuff when I was a kid and Terminator. And I kind of got that somebody made the movie. Like, I knew that it was more than just the actors doing it. And because at that point, filmmakers like Tarantino, they were people were kind of putting the focus on them and being like, this is a Spielberg film, this is a Fincher film or whatever. And I was more interested in that than writing it or acting in it. I was like, I want to make the movie. And so since I was like 6 years old, I was like, that's what I want to do is just, and I started just filming toys and stuff and never really prepared myself to do anything else. So now I'm in a jam.
Well, I'm glad you were able to fully dive in. We have to feed our passions, that's for sure. So we're so happy to have you. So I want to jump over here to Neil McKay. Neil, we actually, with as you guys all know, Gary, Neil Riley, and I all we work and own with Lead Feather Productions, and we partnered with Neil McKay on his horror movie that's about to come out here at the beginning of 2022. So Neil, why don't you give everybody kind of a brief rundown of what you've been up to recently, how you got into film and your story?
Sure. Yeah. I'm working with a couple of friends collaborating on a action horror. So we're very initially in the ideation kind of phase of it. Hoping to maybe shoot that late 2022 or 2023. I'm kind of in a queue with distribution, waiting for them to kind of do all of these deliverables to get us on a platform. But this is for Trip. That's a horror movie. Where you guys, Leadfeather, were a co-production company with 611 Films, which is my production company with Dave Groves. We're partners on that. He's a LA-based filmmaker. So we shot Trip in 2019, and I can't believe it's taken over 2 years to get it out there. But I think there was a lot of things with like COVID slowing things down. It just took a while to get. Well, it's still going through the whole distribution thing. They got a queue. They're doing marketing materials and all this other stuff. So that's the recent stuff. This Trip was my first movie in something like 15 years because I kind of fell out of filmmaking for a long time. Yeah, kind of an extended hiatus for a lot of various reasons. Anyway, so now I'm back. But I guess my little story about I was 6 years old watching Gremlins and I loved the movie. And then I was asking my mom, I was like, who creates the Gremlins? And she thought I meant like, you know, who creates the puppets or whatever. I was like, I don't know, who comes up with the idea of that? And she was like, it's probably a screenwriter. And I said, all right, that's what I want to be when I grow up. And it never really changed. I just realized, oh, there's more stuff than just the screenwriting. You know, there's the whole making the movie. But yeah, just kind of similar to Polaris' story with, you know, the Spielberg, Indiana Jones stuff. You just latch onto that and go, oh, I want to do that. That sounds cool. So,
absolutely, so
that's my story.
Yeah, it seems like the majority of all of us, it typically hits from an early age. So you're kind of born to do it. You know, it grabs hold of you, and that desire to storytell, it just never leaves. And you got to feed it, man. So I'm glad that you decided to, even though you took a 15-year hiatus, that you went back to it later on and you were still able to come out with something that you were proud of. So I'm excited to see it, man. I really am. So let's jump over to Matt. Matt, it's kind of the same thing. What got you started? What have you been working on recently, or what have you done in the past that you kind of want to hang your hat on? Give us a little insight to you.
Yeah, so I was a movie kid growing up. I just always would go to the movies like once a week with my dad, seeing them all. I know the first movie I ever cried in, and I'm kind of ashamed to admit it, that it was Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. But I also kind of love that it is that movie as well, just because it's just a little bit of ridiculous Tom Cruise, but it's a great movie in itself as well. And so I was always a movie kid. I moved around a lot too, so I was, you know, was spin and tail and stuff like that, trying to make new friends at each school. And when I eventually settled down in the suburbs of Chicago, I got really good group of friends, and it started kind of as a joke. I wrote my first movie at 14, and it's not a magnum opus. It's a stoner zombie apocalypse movie called THZ, and I don't know, it's a special little movie. It's kind of stupid, but it's got a spot in my heart I can't deny. And then when I went to college, I made a movie with Angus T. Jones, who you may know as Jake from 2.5 Men. Him and I made a short together, and so the short's nothing too special, if I'm going to be perfectly honest. It was a good first try, but you know, that's the beauty of it, is there's always the next movie. And it went around some festivals here and there, but it didn't ever really get any traction, sadly. But I just am kind of a next project kind of guy. My big thing right now is I just acquired the story rights, a one-year shopping agreement for Betsy Coleman's life story. And she's a very prominent figure here in Chicago. She's a badass black woman that's like the black Amelia Earhart. They told her she couldn't learn to fly. She said, screw them, went to France, came back and did air shows over the very city that denied her. So I'm really excited to get that started on a major level here in Chicago.
Absolutely, man. I remember when you were telling me about this, when I got to come out to Chicago and hang with you for a couple days, a couple months ago. And I'm super pumped to see what you're able to accomplish with that and her story, because I was not familiar with it until you had mentioned it to me. I had never heard of her before. You know, when you said Black Amelia Earhart, I was like, well, yeah, I know Amelia Earhart for sure. But that story in itself is going to be pretty damn entertaining. So excited to see what you can do with it.
Can I ask you, Matt, how old are you? Last Samurai is kind of a recent movie.
I'm 26.
Oh, okay. I was
very stoic.
Oh yeah. I was like, this guy, nothing got to him. E.T., nothing.
No, it's just the first conscious one I got. And for whatever reason, it's fucking Tom Cruise, man. It's the cherry blossom scene at the end of the movie. And it's when I forget his name, but he's also in Inception.
Watanabe.
Yeah, when Watanabe just goes like, ah, oh, it's perfect. And he's ready to like lose his life on the battlefield. I don't know. It just got to me. So
it's forever
been ingrained.
Gary, shut up. Spoiler alert, guys. If you haven't seen it, it's been 20 years. Go see it. So really quick before we move on to the individual portion, Gary and Neil, I want to throw this to you. When was kind of the first minute that you guys realized you wanted to be filmmakers, or that you at least wanted to be involved in film? Neil Riley, I want to throw it to you real quick.
I mean, I always had a love of film growing up. I never thought it was anything really obtainable. It was always seemed like a out of reach dream that, you know, I'd never be able to achieve. But then going through high school, you know, I did theater with you guys, and that was my first foray into the acting experience. And then when we started our nonprofit theater company, the Arts Project of Austin, I decided to do more of the backstage work. And that's what really called to me was, you know, putting all the work in to make the production happen. And then after that, things just snowballed. And now it's, you know, one step closer to being my full-time job. So that's my story of how I got here.
Absolutely, man. Every minute of every day. I can't wait till we can all just do our own creative endeavors full time, as opposed to having day jobs, which we'll get into in a second. Gary, how about you? What was kind of your inspiration? What was your start?
Well, I always liked being on camera, even like as a kid. Back in the day, you had things called camcorders, which were giant cameras that had VHS tapes in them that you record yourself on. And I remember I was probably in first or second grade, and I had some project to do for elementary school, and I enjoyed, you know, being a newscaster on it. And then I was also fortunate enough to have a elementary school that had a lot of theater to it. And then I went to middle school, and that had theater in it as well. And then high school, of course. So I've always really enjoyed the process of creating a story to craft it and to tell a tale that, you know, is just words on paper until you can bring them to life. So I've always been someone who has enjoyed that process throughout my whole life on that. And I've really been fortunate to have, you know, friends and family and circumstances that have allowed me to pursue that in many ways.
For sure. For sure. I did the same thing that you had done, Gary. I had a camcorder that my parents bought when I was younger, and I just used to film my family kind of like a candid camera. A punked kind of thing. I would play pranks on family members and crap. And really that was kind of the start of it. I had always loved doing comedy. And so I had done a kind of a farcical, kind of a spoof on Lord of the Rings when I was, an adolescent with my cousins. And actually, Neil, I think back in the day, I think we did one as well. It was like a follow-up to that.
Didn't we film that one in Oklahoma?
No, you're thinking we filmed one in Austin, but we also filmed one in Houston. That was the James Bond spoof.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. they were all awful, but we found it fun. And we used to show them to our theater class after the weekend was over. And nobody really ever laughed. And if they did, it was usually out of pity and politeness, but it planted the seed. So that's all that matters. So let's jump in here to should indie filmmakers get a second job? I feel like this is an important question for anybody who's ever wanted to make a movie or make a short music video, whatever it is, or get a career in, film, digital media, anything like that. So Polaris, to you, you've been doing this for a while. And what do you think? Should indie filmmakers get a second job? Should they have a day job? Your thoughts?
Well, of course, most indie filmmakers aren't going to make any money for a long time. So, yeah, they need to do something besides crime. But I have a weird little case study where my brother and I are very similar, and he's a filmmaker too. He does filmmaking for his job. He just is doing corporate shoots. He's doing interviews. He's doing short films, features now and then, and sneaking in his own stuff in between. Whereas I don't want to do that. I don't want to sully, you know, I don't think Leonardo da Vinci would have had such passion for making the Mona Lisa if he was painting postcards every day. I feel like I like keeping it separate. So I say, get yourself a job that's really flexible, that's on your time, run an online store, do contract work, whatever. Having a 9-to-5 is not going to fucking work. But if it's lucrative and it's flexible and has nothing to do with movies, I say go for it, because the burnout, you know, is always a problem. I have the weirdest one that's opened up so much possibilities for me, because I do research studies, which is that Robert Rodriguez shit.
Yeah, I was about to say, rebel without a crew.
If you make like $300 a day, you live there, and so you do a research study for 2-3 weeks, you can make a short film. I spent a whopping $200,000 on my short film that I premiered this year at South By, and then the film that beat me in my category cost $5,000. So I was like, well, the joke's on me. But also I was like, $5,000, you can make that. You don't need to kickstart that. You can make that at a research study. So something like that, if you can find a little tricky gig like that. But I wouldn't want to do it as my, I would absolutely want a job outside of film, unless I was being patronized, you know, by the Pope to paint the Sistine Chapel and shit.
So are you opposed to working in the industry as somebody who's part of the crew then?
Some people don't mind that. I do think I used to be a gaffer. That's what I would do when I lived in New York, is I go, gaffing is pretty fucking far from writing and directing. So it felt like unloading trucks, but it was still somewhat creative. So I didn't mind that, but it was separate. And, but yeah, some people, they're different. They, and if you can direct commercials all day and move up in that thing and eventually, you know, do music videos for Madonna and, you know, direct a feature, that's great. But I think for most of us, it's about really trying on something in secret and then premiering it at the best place you can and kind of coming out of nowhere. Working up on the ladder is actually, I don't know if it really exists anymore unless you get some pretty good connections in college or something.
Sure. Perfect. So Neil McKay, same question to you. Do you think indie filmmakers should have a second job, a day job?
Well, yeah, to Polaris's point, you got to make some money somehow. And I have a day job that has nothing to do with movie making. I'm in government contracts, so like boring 9-to-5, basically. But I can see, you know, like how if you wanted to be like an editor, say, and then you're like an assistant editor somewhere at some TV station for, you know, 5-10 years doing all the grunt work. You know, it's like it takes the passion out of it, so keep it separate. So that I felt like that was a good point that Paul Harris made. But my kind of thing I've always felt is that, like, I always wanted to be a writer director. So of course I want to hone my craft in those two areas, but I also need to know, you know, about acting and about editing and cinematography and all of these things. So whether it's a YouTube video or a class or actually taking a job doing it at, you know, whatever level you can do it at, I think is beneficial, just so you know all of the different aspects of, you know, the production and post-production, what other people are, you know, doing, and you have a, you know, a better chance of like running your set better or understanding what they're doing or, you know, all of that. So yeah, I guess that'd be my take.
Sure. So Matt, to you, actually, this is how Matt and I met. We were both working on a TV show, essentially doing kind of like key PA swing grip stuff. And he and I met. So we actually both kind of, to y'all's point, we're not obviously in the writing and directing field getting paid for it, but we're getting as close as we can. So Matt, what's kind of your take on that with the day job, being in the field or not being in the field?
You know, I've always just been in the field. I've actually never had a day job that wasn't in the industry. I'm a firm believer in like the lunch pail of just going in every day, taking your lumps, getting the coffee you don't want to get, dealing with all the bullshit that comes with it, because it's the connections that you make. And like, for example, this Betsy Coleman project, I was just doing PA work on a docuseries for Curiosity Stream about her. And I met Gigi, who's her lovely great, great niece. And I was talking to her. I was like, hey, I mean, why has this not been made into a movie? And so she was going on about how, like, oh, the family, they had been approached back in the 40s, and they were like, hey, can we make a movie? And surprise, it was going to be super racist. And so they were very opposed to doing that. And so I asked them if they had an exclusive with Curiosity Stream, and they didn't. And so, you know, it's just finding those little gems that while you're doing, you know, work. And I also think it keeps you humble. is because, you know, like, I like to think, you know, I know my shit and blah, 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 but nothing breaks you down like PA work. And so,
amen to that.
Yeah. And I just think it's, I don't know, that's how I've always approached it. And, you know, I think you learn like little details here and there of like watching people do their jobs. Like, I just finished up with an Apple TV show here in town, and they're some of the most talented people in Chicago on the crew. And just watching their thought process in that, I think, makes me a better filmmaker, just because, you know, I'm picking up little things here and there and just dealing with the overall politics of it. Was a crew of 100 and some people, just learning how the inner politics of that work, especially as I try to go into a larger scale.
I think that's a good learning thing that you mentioned there, is some of the most I learned that demystified filmmaking was when I first moved to New York in my early 20s, and I was like just an extra on Men in Black 3. And I go, okay, what does it look like actually lighting a $150 movie? How many lights do they really fucking have here? How fast did they shoot? How many shots do they get a day? What am I compared to? And how much direction do you need to give Will Smith? You know, and these questions are impossible to answer unless you're just in the room looking at them.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's certainly benefits to being in the industry with the passion and something that you love, because you can make connections and learn from people. But I can also understand the other side, the argument of you don't want to burn yourself out. I think both are really key elements for a decision for a filmmaker to make. What do I want to do? What route do I want to take? And on the subject of making money, Matt, we'll loop back around. I want to start with you. How did you find funding for your films? A lot of filmmakers, the biggest problem they run into with shorts, music videos, features, whatever, is finding the money for it. What route did you take? What would you recommend to people listening?
I was actually lucky to be in a financial position where I could pay for my movie with Angus. It was I paid it out of pocket slowly and surely. I was working with a great company here in town called Big Shoulders Digital Video Production, and they were willing to work with me. I mean, originally they wanted 55 grand, but, you know, I was talking to the president and kind of, you know, just being like, well, you know, let's cut it back a little bit here and there. And they were willing to work with me, and they gave me a very great crew for it too. So, but I usually try to, like, if I am doing little side projects here and there, I actually use the stock market as my, as memeable as that sounds, I use the stock market to help finance some of my things, because I can take, you know, the little bit of money I make on set doing this and that and throw it back onto a portfolio, trusting my own research and kind of, you know, get out while you can. I've been very lucky with some stocks recently. And so it's made it a lot easier transitioning and following what I'm trying to do.
Interesting. I would never have thought of that as a route to go. That's actually, it's a pretty good one. So Neil McKay, how about you? Where did you find your funding, or what would you recommend to people that are looking to, let's say, their budgets, you know, it could be anywhere from $10,000 to $500,000. You know, where did you start?
So for Trip, I actually, the majority of it, I funded myself. I got a little bit of money from my dad, but, you know, not like a ton, but he gets an executive producer credit because he gave him, but,
yeah, right.
So, but yeah, so I've done crowdfunding before, and to be honest, I just think it's a pain in the ass, and just all of the things like, okay, if you give this much money, you know, you get a t-shirt or this, and then just keeping track of all of that is almost like a full-time job. And so it's like, if you want to put in the work, I mean, sure, it's a good way to do it, but it's also like, you got to be that guy like, hey, give me money for my movie. And it's just, if you can do it yourself, it's just cleaner and easier that way. But then where do you get the money? And it's like, well, you know, the credit cards save money, all that other stuff. I just happen to have kind of, you know, I kind of saved and stuff, and I just happen to have a little bit of surplus money where I was like, okay, I can, you know, fund this, and hopefully it makes money. If it doesn't, you know, I'm not, you know, killing myself for spending my life savings. But I mean, where there's a will, there's a way. I mean, I, you know, you if you believe in the project, do it, and you know, find the money however you can. But yeah, it just seemed easier that way to do, you know, self-financing. And I'm also pretty like pragmatic and, you know, realistic about, you know, budgets and things like that. And if somebody says, oh, I need, you know, $200,000 to make a movie, I'm like, well, you could probably do it for 50 to 100K. I'm just using that as an example.
I think true, though.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and there's ways. Like, I'm not saying you got to cut corners, and I mean, you got, obviously want to pay people to be and all this stuff, and don't, you know, don't be that guy that's like, you know, copying credit, you know, get exposure, like, you know. But I think you can balance a budget better than a lot of people do, and they'll sit there and say they need $500,000 to make a movie when that they don't, they might not even have need half of that. So.
Yeah, it's really important to be able to go through those kind of tedious processes with the budget, and I don't want to say cut corners, but you have to trim the fat at some point, and you have to get it down to a realistic number, and then get creative. Polaris, how about you? I know you had mentioned the thing about the case studies, but was there anything else that you did, or the test studies?
Oh, I did everything I could. I applied to every credit card until they shut me down. So, but really, I think don't be afraid to ask, because if you're a good person who's been there for other people, they'll be there for you. Not only will they donate their time, but one of your friends has probably had a grandparent who's left them some money, or, you know, has something, or can loan you their car or whatever. I happen to have a friend, one of my best friends, her brother died in Iraq, and they gave their family a settlement. So she has like $100,000, $150,000, something in her account. And when I really got in a jam, I was like, can you just lend me like $20,000? And she was like, of course, you helped me with my this and all that. And family members would give me a little money, and I paid it all back. But a lot of people be too afraid to ask for a little thousand here or there. And the other thing I think you can do is maximize your budget. There's a dollar amount that you're going to hit where you go, I can't get any more from anybody, or my credit cards, or my own job. But you can maximize it by going, well, what do I have? Oh, I have an uncle who has a beach house. Oh, we can shoot on the beach house. There's production value there. I have a friend who's a race car driver, whatever the fuck. And you can ride around that. But even more so, you can plan the shit out of your movie. My movie, to maximize the budget, I storyboarded everything with video storyboarding. I video storyboarded. I know what lenses I want. Oh. I know everything. Oh. It was crazy, but I also knew who was in the shot and who wasn't. After all things are done, I go, okay, I don't need my expensive actor here. He's actually not in that fucking shot. And then I organize it, and I go, there are 10 shots with just this, you know, just Clara. Then there are 15 more shots with Clara and me. And then there are, you know, 10 shots with just me and Bill. And I scheduled it that way. So the first day was just me and Bill. And then it was me, Bill, and these other people. And then Lance Hendrickson for just 2 days. And then any other scene Lance is in, I'm using shoulder doubles, hand doubles. My brother's hands look like an old man's hand, so it works. But and I would just do that to maximize the budget. And if anyone's heard of The Primer, that's one of the more famous low budget movies that did pretty well. He did the same thing. He took a DSLR and he took a still frame of every single shot in his movie and edited completely in camera like I did. And that's a way that you can really plan the shit out of your thing and maximize your budget. And you know how many days you need, you know who you need there, and no one is on the clock longer than they need to be.
Okay. So to open it up to you guys, nobody had really brought up, I guess, Neil McKay, you kind of briefly touched on it, but crowdfunding and investors, just out of curiosity, and Neil, Riley, and Gary, if you guys want to jump in, please do. Where do we go from the crowdfunding source? Where do we go from finding investors? Did any of you have any luck doing that? Because I know with Gary, Neil, Riley, and I, we had done a short film, only ended up costing, what would you guys say, about $2,000 or so to do Eye of the Beholder?
About was our first short film. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
A classic, if I may add.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah,
Matt, I did show up. Matt did enjoy it. In the end, we called in a lot of favors. It was the one project we felt so strongly about that we said, okay, we're going to call in our few friends in the industry and they're going to work for peanuts because we've been there for them on this. And Polaris, to your point, it's that same thing. We didn't ask for money, but we asked for time. And that's also a very valuable resource for most people. And some people said no, but some said yes. And when they said no, you're not sullying the relationship or anything. You're not ruining it. You're just kind of right back where you started. You know, if you like, I agree, players, 100%. If you're too afraid to ask, you're not going to ever take the next step. Ever.
I was always surprised just by asking what people were willing to do. Just, you know, and I'm like, wow. By the way, Johnny worked on my movie for 2 days or 3 days.
I did.
I remember. So thank you. He's one of the lovely people who said yes.
And it was fun. It was a good time. You know, I feel a lot of people, some people you'll never know, for those of you out there listening that have never done this before or are just getting into it. You can even ask people that aren't in the industry. Some people just want to get on set and they might offer to be a PA. They might offer to do some crafty for you. They might offer to be your medic. You know, they might offer to be security or extra hands for the grip team. Anything like that. They just want to get on set because they've always been fascinated by being a part of film, by being a part of the process. And you never know unless you actually ask.
Yeah, a lot of those people do. It makes it a lot more accessible to people because, you know, they might just have a wandering curiosity of it, but they don't want to devote their entire lives to it. So you can give them the option to, hey, do you want to, you know, be an extra in this gallery scene? And, you know, they'll, you know, say, sure. Yeah. Or even if it's somebody who's an actor, if they, you know, if it's just like a really ultra low budget thing, like Eye of the Beholder was, you know, they might want to just do it for fun if it's just going to be, you know, an afternoon. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and don't be afraid of Craigslist. Just right. you need hands, you need people. The weirdos will come out of the woodwork and they will be weird, but they will fucking help
in
you.
In droves.
I had a guy on my set who was a will work for food person, a woofer. And he was like, oh, I'll build your set with you. For weeks, he helped me.
I remember this guy.
Okay. And he was an ex-con. He was old. He was this drifter guy. But he was like, I just need a place to sleep and buy me some cigarettes and some food once in a while. I would have never relied on that, but he saved my ass several times just because I asked not only my friends, I asked the universe, like, who do you got, you know?
Mm-hmm. And to Neil McKay's point, I think it was Neil, you were saying this about trying to keep track of everything if you were going to do like, you know, crowdfunding and tiers. Like Leadfeather recently got onto Patreon, you know, I think has been, it's really helpful because like they'll like for our highest tier, they'll make, you know, sweaters and t-shirts and, you know, little items like that. And then they'll ship it out and we don't have to do anything about that. But it lets people not only support us, but and they get their little items and we don't have to waste any time, you know, keeping track of who owes what, you know, because the third party Patreon just kind of steps in there and does that. And I think that's been really helpful because a lot of artistic and creative people, I think, use Patreon to kind of have a way to get money without having to spend their entire time managing a production side of the business that they're not interested in doing. So I think that's become much more accessible.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Yeah, that they're doing that. I would think, for a small nominal fee, they would, you know, help you out and be like, hey, we'll do this and this and we'll send automatic emails out on your behalf or something like that. Like, that's a smart play on their part.
Yeah,
absolutely. As far as a third party gaining money or access or anything like that. I know. So Neil Riley, to you, since we had used crowdfunding with a few different productions, in particular Eye of the Beholder, how do you think it worked? Is it something you would recommend to people? Do you think they should go another route?
I don't know. To me, the crowdfunding source, things like GoFundMe, the juice isn't worth the squeeze because 99% of the people that are donating to your crowd source are your friends and family. So you might as well just go direct to the source, be like, hey, this is the budget I'm looking for. What can you do to give me a hand? Because it's very rare that someone's just clicking around on these random crowdsources like, oh, that's a film that needs budget? Here, let me throw some money at it. To me, we never got any kind of real return on it. It was time taken away from the project to put up the crowdsource, to make a video about the crowdsource, to follow up with emails, to set it all up. To me, it was never worth it.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Neil. I don't know if it works on a project by project basis, but I think I think where Patreon has most famously been working well is our areas like, you know, Twitch streamers for video games, where they've got a consistent source of fans that want to see them generate more and more content. So if you can get to the point where, you know, you've got, you know, 100 or 200 people that are each willing to throw you a dollar or two a month to make whatever you're going to make, then that's enough to, you know, start your platform and get moving on.
Yeah, I agree. If you're going to be consistently coming out with new content, things like Patreon is a great source. But doing it for a single project, it just has never worked out.
It doesn't seem like it does necessarily very often. You come across those one hit wonders, the games or the new interesting invention. Every once in a while, you'll see those have a budget of $200,000 on Indiegogo or GoFundMe, and they'll exceed that, you know, to $500,000 or $1 million. But those are pretty rare. If you go through and actually go down the rabbit hole of looking at how many things are on those crowdfunding sites, there are so many that barely even make, you know, what, a quarter, a fifth of what they're asking for, maybe even less. So Matt, to you, have you ever used crowdfunding before? Is this something you would recommend to people?
I personally have not done crowdfunding before, but I would recommend it. See, I think it's one of those, it's almost like the Patreon streaming thing. If you build up enough notoriety, it's easier to build that community and have that kind of support you and stuff like that. But I do agree with the census of, like, on a project-to-project basis, if you're not, you know, like, not common knowledge, but if people haven't really heard of you, you don't have a very big audience, it may be a little bit tougher to reach those higher goals unless you know that you're that diamond in the rough and it just, all things are going for you.
Yeah. Now, Polaris, to you, had that ever crossed your mind to do crowdfunding at all? I know you had kind of asked, you had gone a bunch of different avenues, but crowdfunding, is that something right. that you ever considered?
With a budget, like, that I was kind of wanting to do, I could probably make, you know, 30,000, 40,000 crowdfunding, you know, and but I'd still have a lot to do. I'm still thinking about doing it. I still owe about 50,000 on my movie to my friends. But I did take a crowdfunding class. I took a course that included film crowdfunding, and the Kickstarter guy was one of the people running it. And really what the deal was, what I concluded from it is you can't do this shit on your own. You have to have like a little guru who's going to take a few thousand from you and go, I can get you this money, but you're going to have to do everything I fucking say. And a lot of what it was basic marketing about who to target and what to do, but also like you need to use Tweepy and get 100 followers on Twitter every day. And you need to start doing this for 3 months before you launch so that you will have thousands of Twitter followers. And Tweepy helps you target people who like your kind of movie, whatever. You need to use this system to friend every. It's a lot of gaming the algorithm stuff so that you can get it out there. And, you know, if your movie's about skeet shooting, it will find the skeet shooters and they will look at it and it'll go. His whole thing was about how to get it beyond your circle of friends. And I don't think you can do it alone. I think you need to hire a specialist to do that and somebody who can guide you through it. Or at least take a course. And since then, I have been kind of doing it, but I've been preparing for possibly kickstarting and gaining. You know, I have like 5,000 Facebook friends, and I know 1,000 of them because I just use his methods to get all these people, and I get thousands of Twitter followers and stuff. And but I'm not fully using his methods. I'm supposed to be posting every other day on certain things and certain sites and all that. And I'm just like, because I do the, you know, different avenues. I'm like, this is all just to get me another 35,000 if I can. But I will say, not to ramble too long, I will say that in order for anyone to donate to you who doesn't know you, you have to, when I donate to Kickstarter sometimes, and it's when I go, this guy's a diamond in the rough. This girl's got an idea, or this person's technique is great, or I love stop animation, or, you know, cheeky stuff. And so you have to have some sort of work sample. And a lot of these Kickstarters, I look and I go, it looks like they already made the fucking movie. They got shots, they got behind the scenes footage, they got like interviews with the actors. And I go, I wouldn't donate to them if I didn't have some proof of quality. So right. Where is that going to come from? Your own pocket and your friends. So you can kickstart, but at some point you have to fund yourself and you have to come up with a good work sample. And if you don't nail it, you got to try again before you can actually ask other people for their money.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. You know, people want to already invest in, they want to have their money invested in something that's going to take off. Kevin O'Leary, one of the entrepreneurs on Shark Tank, always says that he wants to pour kerosene or gasoline on an already existing fire. He doesn't want to pour it on something that, you know, on just kindling. He doesn't want to start there, you know, and I think that's a good way to look at it. So, Neil McKay, is this something you had ever considered, the crowdfunding route?
I had, and I've done it. I mean, it's been a while. But just kind of to what we were just talking about a minute ago, it just seems like kind of to what Neil was saying. It's just the you know, it's just not worth the squeeze. It felt like a lot of work,
right.
You know, back then just with keeping track of it all. Now what Gary's saying, like, yeah, that'll cut, that'll cut into it and everything. But, there's still a lot, you know, to keep track of and everything like that. And it's probably better, yeah, just to go directly to your friends, like on an email or something. Now I'm intrigued by this, what Polaris was saying with that website that'll kind of do algorithms and get you out there. I don't want to jump the gun here, but I'm wondering, you know, that applies to like the social media kind of thing and like getting people to see your movie once your movie's done. Like, well, how do you get it out there and how do you get people to see it? And do you use social media? I don't know if, you know, they have like people that do that get it outside of your network of friends.
I will say that they're cracking down on algorithm hacking. That's why the Kickstarter guy was like, Instagram's pretty hard because they're purposely making it hard to become viral nowadays. They want you to go on Facebook and they want you to pay for Facebook ads. So they're pushing off to Instagram, but Twitter is a separate thing. So you can still kind of game the Twitter setup. But that's another thing to not be afraid of. Like you talking about getting your movie out there. I don't know why filmmakers don't want to pay for some ads, just little ads. A little bit of money to pop up, yeah, on people's feeds. I know a guy who made a reasonably okay music video, but he just paid like $200 to get it on YouTube's homepage and put an ad on it, and he's got, you know, tens of thousands of views now. And it's just like, yeah, it's a little money goes a long way if you're not afraid of ads.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I had a friend who did the same thing. This was years ago, but I directed a music video for him, and then he did something on YouTube where it like punched it out to like a bunch of people, and all of a sudden he had like thousands of views in a day. And I was like, wow, okay. You know, it was just a nominal amount, you know, to pay for that.
Yeah, I think so. Piggybacking off the social media aspect, social capital. This is building a social media presence with your audience, typically ahead of the movie's release. Do you guys find that to be imperative to a film's success? What did you do to promote your own film before it was actually released? Neil McKay, we'll start with you. Had you done anything with Trip as far as, you know, the Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, whatever, YouTube, anything like that? Had you done any pre-marketing stuff?
Yeah, that's a great question. I had, we did actually, every production day, we would do a little, like vodcast, like video.
That's right. Vlog, yeah.
Thing. That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You and Gary were on that.
We were.
It was a fun little thing. We'd have a guest on sometimes and we just talk about the day and like the trials and tribulations and things like that. And we were putting them up on YouTube and under Dave Groves, who's the producer on the movie, under his YouTube page. And, you know, it was getting some views and people seemed to like it. And then, you know, I was posting pictures on my Instagram and he was doing the same. But we just kind of, because it took so long to make the movie, there was this like lull. And at this point, it's like, if I had done anything, like I put out the teaser poster on Facebook, like in July, like it's like, hey, coming soon. But at this point, everyone's long forgotten it. And it's like, I kind of feel like when you're ramping up to the release, that's when you pound it. I don't know if people are going to remember something from, you know, you post a poster or a trailer or something 4 months before the movie comes out. It's sort of like, you know, I don't know what the sweet spot is, but maybe a month or two before, and then you just start hammering, you know, the social media. Here's the trailer. Here's the teaser. You know, here's production stills, the poster, all of that stuff, and then get people interested in it. Because otherwise, I think they'll forget, and they'll be like, oh yeah, that's right, you got a movie coming out.
Yeah, so it almost might hinder you in some aspects, because if you wait too long or something like COVID happens, or who knows, family issues or something like that, it might just become stale and stagnant after a while. So Polaris, how about you? Had you done anything with Reklaw in particular before you went on the festival circuit with social media?
I kind of scrambled at the last minute, because during filming and I was working on Reklaw up until a week or two before I even showed it South by Southwest. They were like sending me emails being like, where's the movie file, dude? And I'm like, oh, there's a snow apocalypse and my power went out. Got to have another, you know, I was color correcting in my car when the power was out during the snow thing here in Texas. So I didn't have any fucking time to do it. And then as soon as I was done, I was like, all right, I got to get on there and start posting stuff. I felt bad because I built a set and I did all this shit. I could have really used that. But as far as the marketing thing with social media, I feel like there's no room for the mid and the low tier stuff. Like, yeah, if you have 3 million subscribers on YouTube, you're going to get somewhere with that. But anything really in the levels I could get, you know, I don't think it really made much of a difference. I think what I focus on as a, I think is a smart thing to focus on is getting other people stamps of approval, getting an agent that people have heard of. Oh, CA, you know, whatever the good one is, ACA or whatever. I know a guy who is represented by them, and then he gets meetings through that. Or if you get in a good festival, or you're on a good network, or you have a good movie star that you've heard of, that'll get you so much further than like posting. I don't know a single damn actor or director or something who goes, I got where I'm at because of my followers. Unless they had the most fucking followers on TikTok I've ever heard of, you know? So it's, we're all scrambling for a spot that I'm never going to be able to get to. So I'm a little cynical about the social media stuff.
Well, okay. I think that with marketing, that's usually the biggest expenditure of any major motion picture is the marketing. It usually is 2 to 3 times the budget of the actual film. So that's why when you see like, oh, this movie made $400 million. It actually lost money because, you know, they spent, you know, $300 million on advertising. But I think that especially when you're doing like a project based rather than just a continuous kind of company based thing where you're like open all the time and you're just like having an event. Yeah, marketing's like a key thing to have. And it's important to start that early in the process and probably, you know, as you were saying, you know, spend the money to have someone who knows how to do it, because ultimately, if people don't consume the art that you make, you're not going to be able to make more art because, you know, then you're going to be $50,000 in debt with a film that nobody's watched.
Sure, sure. Matt, what's your take on that? What do you think about having a social media presence before the initial film's release?
I think it would be a good idea. It's kind of one of those things that I fucked up and didn't have that when I made the Angus thing, which there's a lot of marketing angles I could have gone with because he had stepped away from acting and wasn't very happy. And this is something I don't know how I convinced him to do it, but I somehow did. And so it was one of those like could have totally worked that angle super well. I was just kind of young and didn't have the experience and like the whole grand scheme of what it needs to be for it to kind of get some traction. And I really think that would have helped me on the festival circuit. It would have had a little bit more notoriety to it and people would have had that name recognition you want in a piece, especially on the festival circuit where people have heard about it or they like, you know, it helps kind of in an unconscious way give you a little bit of bias. And I think that's something, there's a lot of psychology to marketing your movies and things of that nature. So it's definitely something I learned. It's definitely something I've thought about a lot more moving forward with some of my projects and how I'm going to actually market them. And I've done some more marketing work here in town, in Chicago as well, just kind of trying to hone that aspect of my craft.
Go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to say, yeah, marketing's weird. Well, personal marketing. If you doing a company marketing your movie, yeah, that's going to make or break the success of your film. But doing it yourself as a social media, just an individual, it's something where I go, definitely do it if you can. But I've also known films who've gotten into huge festivals, gotten sold to distributors, you know, gotten big deals, who didn't do any of it. And so it's like, you're hedging your bets, but that's really all you're doing. You're not really, you can't get anywhere on marketing alone, especially by yourself. So it is a thing where I'm like, do it if you want to. You could absolutely get a little further with it. It can absolutely help. But if you didn't do it, it's not like you ruined your fucking movie's possibilities.
And I think a part of the, I would say almost fear, I guess, is, you know, some of these people, it's their first movie, you know, they're anxious, they don't know if it's going to be any good. And that kind of, I think that fear kind of stops some people. And it's just one of those things, say, fuck it. You know, you're just putting it out in the world. You know, if you like it, you do. If you don't, oh, well, it's just one of those things. So, you know, I think there's, because a lot of filmmakers are kind of introverts sometimes, and they don't really want to be that person, if I had to put it away. Where they're like, yeah, I'm that guy that's, you know, peddling my stuff all over Facebook. It's like sometimes you need to do that because you never know who's going to see it. I guess another, going back to my own movies, I'm just not a big social media person. I really don't. I mean, like, I get why it's important and everything, but it's just not really who I am as a person that I like feel the need to share my life. I don't even have a Twitter. So it's just one of those, I don't know. It's kind of a personality thing, but it's definitely something you should do.
And the fact that it's even a question that you're asking means it's not obvious. It's like, well, do we really need to do this? It's still kind of up in the air. It's still kind of the Wild West.
Yeah, there's no handbook for how to do it. I mean, you had talked about going the Robert Rodriguez route originally, you know, with the you know, he happened to I had just finished reading Rebel Without a Crew a couple months ago. And, you know, he talks about how he got found. You know, he made his entire movie for what was his budget, like $10,000 or something like that, to make Mariachi, or whatever the heck the name of his first one was. But advertising back then in the 90s is so much different than advertising in the 2000s and then the 2010s and now. So that handbook continuously is changing. So yeah, I don't think there's a standard rubric on how to do it. There's not like one mainstream road that you have to take. I think it's kind of just throwing a bunch of shit at the wall and maybe seeing what sticks. I know it sounds kind of messy and discombobulated, but at the same time, we don't really know how to do it. We just have guesses, you know, unless you have one of those big budget companies backing you up, or a marketing firm of some kind, or a PR firm, then yeah, there is no standard way to do it. That's a good point. So moving on from the marketing aspect, I kind of wanted to jump into the basic rundown or the day-to-day operations of being an indie filmmaker, and kind of taking us through the process from pre-production to post, even distribution and the festival circuit. So it's been established that all of us have day jobs. Even if it's working in the industry, we all have day jobs or some other form of getting money. We're not just honing our craft and building it every single day. We do other things. So for the three of you, Polaris, we'll start with you. When did you find time to develop your idea, write your script, start doing your, any of your storyboarding, anything like that? How did you kind of start? How did the idea come to you? What was a day in the life of you like? Like, you'd wake up in the morning and then for 12 hours, you're boom, 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 pedal to the metal. I'm not going to stop until I have to go to sleep. I'm just going to work on my movie. Or was it, I do 3 hours this day and 7 hours the next day? What was your process?
It was a lot more the first one, the 12 hours, boom, boom, boom for a while. I am not one of those people. Writers can maybe do that where they have to have a system and they go up in their little shed in the back away from their kids or whatever, and they work for 6 hours a day. But if you're an indie filmmaker, you're doing a lot more than writing. So you're doing everything. And I personally am like, you have to treat this like a vacation or a wedding or buying a house or something where it is a break from normal, where it's like, if you want to write a script, you have to save up some money, go fucking to your grandma's guest house or rent a cabin and the thing and bang it out. Because if you try and pick at it all the time, just all the time is going to get away from you. And I think that goes for everything, where I'm kind of like, when I talk to other artists, whether they be actors or music, you know, filmmakers or whatever, usually they have to take a little break to do it. You know, St. Vincent was, right. I was listening to her talk and she was like, yeah, I rented a hotel in Portland. I just started and I worked on the album for like a month rather than try and just pick at it all the time. And that works for me, but I've been working on this movie for fucking ever, so I can't take 5 years off. But I do think that, like, I even put off my, I'm married now, but I even put off my wife, where I met a girl and I go, oh, I really like this girl. I'd like to have a relationship, but I am filming my movie this year and I'll call her when it's over. And I literally hoped that no one else snatched her up.
Your true love.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that a lot of people go, man, I haven't gotten anywhere in my career. I go, have you really stopped to prioritize it? Even if you're an actor, have you stopped to go do an intensive month-long workshop or film a new reel all yourself or go to pilot season? So to me, it's all about prioritizing it and not treating it like a part of your life. Because films are, you know, it's not a 9-to-5. To some people it is, but for an indie filmmaker, it really is like this thing that you have to like force yourself into, because they're not going to invite you. You have to like really like make it happen. So yeah, I it's all or nothing for me. I have to take a break from life to do it.
Let me ask you, how many times did you get disheartened and thought, because I remember when I was with the production company I was with before we started Lead Feather was Bad Hero Productions in Austin. And we took in scripts every week and we would do weekly workshops and we took in Reklaw. I don't remember the name that you had for it originally.
It was Redeemers, I think. Yeah.
Redeemers. That's right. And we did a read through. We brought in actors and we brought in other writers and producers and we kind of talked about it and then gave feedback. So that was, God, that was probably, 5 or 6 years ago at this point.
Right.
How many rewrites did you go through? How many times did you just think to yourself, God, I can't fucking do this? And then the next day you're like, no, I can. I got to power through. Let's fucking go. How many times did you almost lose hope?
I think variety always helped me. When you're trying to eat a big meal at Luby's, you have a little bit of the mashed potatoes, a little bit of the, you know, the corn, a little of that, and you can eat it all. But if you just try and eat, you know, one thing at once, you'll get sick of it. What helped me was, as a filmmaker, you have a lot of jobs. As an indie filmmaker, very many of us write, edit, direct, act, all that shit. And if I got too sick of something, I could switch and do something else. But pretty much you have to go. Screenwriting you could do forever. You could just fix your movie and fix your movie and fix your movie. And you have to go, if I'm getting sick of this, then that's my best. Everyone has a best. And it's okay to hit it and go like, this is as good as I can do. And so much of filmmaking is walking away and going, that's the shot, okay? it's not going to win an Oscar, but that's as good as I can do right now in my career. And I wrote the screenplay and I did work on it until I liked it. I would just read it over until I would stop changing things. But then, you know, you come back to it 7 months later and you go, oh, no, I have some new ideas. I don't like this as much as I used to. But taking seven months off and doing something else, and I would work on funding the film, casting it, take breaks, because there's a lot of pre-production to do besides writing. So
right. And you handled all of the pre-production. You were your own casting director, right? You were your own production manager, line producer. You were all these big roles at the beginning, I would assume, because you didn't have the money at the onset to pay other people to help you. Did you collect family members at that point to help with a couple jobs, or did you do everything in pre-production by yourself?
I did pretty much everything, and that's why the movie took so damn long. But it's kind of like some people, I'm sure a lot of you guys agree, filmmaking is kind of a lifestyle where it's like surfing. It's like, I just wake up and I surf a little bit. And I, you know, just every day pick at the movie and go, okay, let's look through some more things. Let's send it some emails. It doesn't bother me. It's calming and I enjoy it. I like just slowly moving towards the end of a task. But with the budget stuff we were talking about earlier, I didn't get to mention that, is that a lot of people are like, how am I going to make this movie? It's going to cost so much. And I go, you can cash in money for time and go, well, I can't hire the best actor in the world, but I can look through 1,000 actors and find an undiscovered one that I would not have found otherwise if I didn't look through 1,000 fucking actors. And that's what I did. My cast is great. Only one of them is a name person that anyone recognizes. But I get a lot of accolades about the cast. And I go, I just looked really fucking hard. And it took a long time.
Yeah, you were casting for a while, I remember. So when you were casting, did you go through, like when we had casted for, when I was with Bad Hero, the company I was with beforehand, we did casting from all over the country. And we had gone, at one point we went to Facebook groups and I jumped into Facebook acting groups in every major city in the continental United States and in Canada. And we got videos sent in from fucking everywhere. And it took us a couple months to decide. And then we flew those people in, and that's how we found. Did you kind of go to the same route? Did you go through a casting agency, or what did you go through?
I did only casting agents at the very end. So what I did is I did major calls and New York and in-person calls in New York and LA and then video ones everywhere else. But I flew out there and I saw everybody who could possibly be in this fucking movie. I was like, that's okay. I'll give you a shot. I saw hundreds of people, found two out of my cast that I liked. And then the rest I go, not good enough. And then I opened my search up and then I contacted pretty much every agent that was feasible in America to contact who wasn't like, you know, representing people way out of my league.
Yeah.
And looked through their people and asked them for selects, found two more people, and then was like, still not whatever. And then I looked through short films of other films that had gone to festivals recently, being like, who are they using? And so forth. So you can even scout out people who you go, well, who maybe doesn't know about my movie or doesn't have an agent I found, but was a good actor and was in Cannes or, you know, South, you know, whatever, Sundance. I looked at them, scouted out my own things. And then finally, when I couldn't find anybody for the leader of the team, I was like, well, I'm going to hire a casting director, and then he's going to make offers to name actors, and I'm going to get him there for 2 days. And I spent the money on that, but it was just because I couldn't find anybody I liked otherwise. Yeah. But you do want to hire a casting director at that level when you're actually reaching out to people. And so I thought, who would be the best person I could possibly get, which would be Willem Dafoe. I was like, he's brought the best person who fit, who's famous. He'd be the top if I had my druthers or whatever. And I found out, has he ever done a short film? He had in the mid-2000s. He'd done a few. I looked at the casting director of those. I hired that guy and said, can you, Willem's booked, but you know, who else can you get to? And that was actually really fucking expensive. So I'm sorry to occupy too much.
No, not at all.
These casting directors are on like retainer. You hire them for a month. You know, it's like $3,000, $6,000 a month, whatever. They'll make a deal with you, but it's thousands a month. And you go, okay, well, he's going to make these offers and I'm going to get the person. Well, that depends on how quickly those movie stars get back to you. My first choice took a month and a half to say no. You just check back with them every 2 weeks and go, hey, how about the short? And he's like, nah, I don't want to even read it right now. I'm too busy. I'm working on Homeland or something. And then eventually you go, can I get an answer? And they go, nah. And then some of them get back to you that day. And then some take a month. And so I had this guy on retainer for months just eating up my fucking money. Yeah. And then finally I get Lance Henriksen, who was like actually my fifth choice. So I had to go through five other actors or four actors. Or I can't remember. And it just took a long time. And I was like, okay, so you need to, one, if you're going to approach stars, you need to back up your casting process so there's time. And two, you need to budget that with a casting director because they're not going to read your fucking email. They need somebody who has a reputation, who has a relationship with them. So only hire these casting people if you're, you know, trying to get at somebody who won't answer your emails otherwise. But it was pricey.
We hope that you are enjoying this rousing episode of Let Feather Productions' I Don't Give a Flick. To help us bring you more of the content that you love, please consider following us on Patreon at patreon.com/letfeather. There are three tiers to choose from, with special and exclusive merchandise in our VIP level. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
I can imagine it was. So the other route going, yeah, jump onto Craigslist, jump onto Facebook, jump onto the actors.net, whatever all that stuff is. But it does sound like you found, because I've seen the short and it was fantastic and it rightly deserved to get into South By, which is, you know, one of the most prestigious festivals in the entire world at this point. and it's very impressive. So I'm very, very happy for you. And I'm glad you were able to find that group, because you have people from Lance all the way down to a mutual friend of ours, Michael Schnick, who, you know, has done a couple small things, but nothing gigantic. So you've got just such a nice variety and diversity within that cast. But it is perfectly cast.
They all hold their own together. They all none of them look like they're out of place. Like that's just a friend or that's a, you know, nobody or whatever. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's good that you're able to have that mindset of diamond in the rough. Don't rush it. We can't all be John Hughes and lock ourselves in our study for 48 hours and come out with Breakfast Club. Not going to happen.
Exactly. And a lot of these successful directors, it's because they found an unknown actor that really kind of mutually helped them out. You know, it's like, you know, you make Shotgun Stories. Well, you also discovered Michael Shannon, and maybe you wouldn't be here if you hadn't got that guy in there. So, you know, you're looking for that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's like, a you know, when Scorsese found De Niro, you know, for Mean Streets kind of thing. It's you find the person and then hopefully it takes hold and it takes you to new heights.
It's an essential part of the casting process. Yeah. Or the filmmaking process is do you have a star that you've discovered or that you've hired? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So moving on to Neil McKay, for you, since you had a day job, how were you able to come out? We'll focus in on Trip. In particular, since that's your most latest film, how was the process for you with pre-production? How was script writing and a 9-to-5? How did you go about casting? How did you go about crewing it up, coming up with your own budget, basically wearing all of the hats at the beginning by yourself? Or did you have some help?
So actually, I was kind of, I was the writer, director, did, you know, the editor and a producer on Trip. I did have help through a filmmaking partner, David Groves, who would just he wasn't involved necessarily with the creation of the story, but kind of I'd bounce ideas off of, like, well, what if this happened or what if that happened? And that was extremely helpful to get kind of, okay, I think this is going to work or not. And then once I felt like I had a pretty good through line of like what the story was, I think that's when him and I kind of, we both produced the movie and we both kind of said, okay, this is what the budget's going to look like. This is how long we think it'll take, you know, pre-production, how many days of shooting, all of that stuff. And then we kind of came up with a deadline with various deadlines of like, okay, I think it's going to take this long, you know, for me, Neil, while I'm, you know, working my day job to write this script, this is how much time we're going to need for pre-production, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think the dates were somewhere in August for like production. And then, you know, so I was like, all right, I'm going to need all of July right. to do pre-prod. So I basically like went on sabbatical. Like I kind of left my job, but I was in a good kind of place where they ended up bringing me back later. But I mean, I took like a few months off to do all of this stuff.
Yeah.
Before I went back. So I do agree. There's no way I would have been able to do all the stuff that I did and work the day job at the same time, because I was basically like living, eating and breathing trip for 2 months. Like once I had left the job.
Right.
But once you kind of have those big ticket items in place, like, okay, this is where I think the money's going to go. And all that changes, you know, how much people you negotiate for rates and who you actually bring on. And, oh, we didn't have enough for, you know, catering or this, that, or the other. But you have kind of an idea of it and, you know, a timeline. And then we kind of went to town. And then it was a matter of like, all right, well, let's bring, you know, so-and-so on board and like get all these pieces together. And then in a lot of ways we would ask, okay, now you're on board, who do you know? And because I ended up getting people involved that were like, yeah, like once you came on board, Johnny, like then you recommended Peggy Schott, who was in the movie. And right. you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden, one of my other actors, Major Dodge, knew somebody in Austin that was a filmmaker, and she knew an audio guy. And so now I have a sound engineer and you know, and all that kind of thing. It's like, you start just, hey, can you help me out? I needed this person. And so there was a lot of that going on with kind of, you know, asking for favors and, you know, right. networking and stuff. And Austin's a great place for that because, you know,
it is.
It's such a small, you know, and tight knit group of, you know, it seems like everybody knows everybody in the film industry out here. Yeah. So now as far as casting, I didn't have any, you know, known actors like Lance Hendrickson or anything. So it was a little bit easier for me to not have to do the waiting game with like up, you know, and dealing with, you know, the back and forth like that way. It seemed like, you know, the cast that I had was kind of like, yeah, they, you know, they're just looking to churn out work. So if I say, hey, can you be ready in like 2 weeks? They're like, yep, I can fit it in. And, you know, you kind of work with that kind of schedule. But I had a casting director, Jamie Beebe, who's based out of Los Angeles, and she had cast David's movies before. So she kind of gave me a friend rate and then gave me kind of what do you call it? The pages of, you know, where you have the headshots and they have the links to the reels and
right.
all that stuff. So I was kind of like looking at all of that stuff, you know, to find people. I was also looking up acting reels of like local Austin actors. And so weirdly enough, Polaris's sister, Akasha, is the lead actor in my movie. And I just found her on YouTube and a shot in the dark, just like, hey, you know, because she had, you know, everybody's got their email at the end of the reel.
Right.
And I just started talking to her about the project and she eventually came on board. So, you know, and then, you know, like I said, you brought on Johnny, you helped me get Peggy. So it's really not like one process. Like there's just a multitude of ways to find, you know, your cast and crew. Yeah, so that was kind of,
yeah, it's all about asking people, you know, it's so awesome to be able to hear each and every one of your individual stories because you guys each took a different route. You know, Polaris is flying all over the country and using a casting director. Neil McKay, you're asking friends and you're getting really deep into the rabbit hole of YouTube and you're checking out reels and I just love that. This is great information for anybody listening in that there's no one way to do it. going through film and TV and digital media, there's no one way to do it. There's no rubric on it. You kind of just got to get in, get your hands dirty and go and try things and hope that it works out. If it doesn't work out, that's a lesson for the future. So Matt, to you, the same question, when you were doing your shorts and the project you're working on right now, how much time do you allocate a week or each day to writing out a script or a treatment or storyboarding or even doing some of the pre-production stuff? Did you have to do a lot of it on your own? Did you have help from family or friends? What was your story on that?
So I I like to bang my head against the wall and write every day. It's
love it.
It's rough, but you do it because, I think Stephen Pressfield said it best when he said, a muse loves a blue collar worker. And, you know, it's just forcing yourself and getting into that habit of, I try to write at least 5 pages a day minimum. And it's just like, even if it's not on the same project and I'm kind of jumping around because I've got a backlog of a bunch of ideas. It's just more, I know that I'm going to get 5 pages at the end of the day, come hell or high water. And it's, you know, within 2 weeks, I've got, you know, enough pages that I have my first act. And so it's just kind of constantly going through that. When it comes to the pre-pro stuff, I was lucky enough to, with the movie I shot with Angus, I shot it in my friend's house. So I had been there enough that I could walk through in my head and try to figure out my shot list. And so I'm a big proponent of going to your environment before you do your shot list, because, you know, sometimes you see something from a certain angle and it changes how you think about the scene. So I always try to kind of lean into the spontaneity that comes in filmmaking, but also having that plan where when spontaneity doesn't happen, you've at least got an idea of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, for sure. And so for all of you guys, I do want to ask, what was the most difficult thing you experienced in pre-production in particular? Matt, we'll start with you. What was the most taxing process that you had to go through or instance that really troubled you?
I think for me, it comes from, I don't know. It's almost like a confidence thing in the material, or it's like, because, you know, when you go into pre-pro, you're like, the project becomes real. And it's one of those, like, is this the right project to, invest how much amount of time in? And so it's just kind of having that confidence in your own voice as an artist and kind of pursuing that. But for me, I mean, sometimes the toughest part of pre-production for me is budget, because it varies so much. You know, so much stuff happens everywhere, mm-hmm. where you're just like, oh, man, I'm going to have to pivot here. Where can I pull money? You know, like if I'm paying, you know, can I sweet talk my camera guy into taking $100 less so I can get nicer catering? You know, some little things like that. That's what keeps me up, is because, you know, I try to be for my crew and think about, you know, the whole, but I also have to get what I want out of the project. And sometimes, you know, it's tougher with the budget.
Sure, sure. Neil McKay, how about you?
So I had a hell of a time with insurance, and I don't know if it's just a unique situation for me, but I was dealing with a company. I guess I saved it for the last minute, or I didn't give myself enough time. And all of a sudden I was like stuck with this company and I'm just trying to get paperwork through. And it was just very difficult, because I think the person you're on the line with is just like a customer service person, and they're not really like an insurance person, you know? So they're just kind of like, oh, well, you need this. And they didn't really know what they were talking about. And I needed to make sure I had, you know, the correct insurance, 'cause I think people were telling me like, all you need is liability. But that really only protects people like outside of the location. So if, you know, some guy come, you know, your next door neighbor or something comes on a set and like trips on a light or something, then that's the insurance you need. But what I needed was like for the cast and crew, if they got injured, to cover them. So that was more workman's comp. Anyway, long story short, I was dealing with this whole issue with the insurance company where they wouldn't sell you one without the other. And I'm trying to get, and so I couldn't get just workman's comp. I had to get liability and workman's comp. And then they're like, yeah, but you only need workman's comp. You don't need liability. And I'm like, yeah, but you only sell them together. So it was just a nightmare just trying to get this straight. And meanwhile, you can't get equipment. You can't rent equipment, like all the lights and stuff, without proof of insurance. We're trying to get this done like at 4 o'clock on a Friday or something before the whole thing shuts down. So it was a total debacle, but we got it sorted out. But man, take care of those things like that as early as you can, because they will bite you in the ass.
Doesn't it always seem on an indie film set like everything comes together at the very last minute? Literally at the very last second, everything seems to just work itself out.
It makes you sweat.
It does make you sweat. Yeah, it's a very stressful. Yeah, I mean, it's probably as stressful as, you know, being an air traffic controller or something. I don't fucking know. Something along those lines. Polaris, how about you? What was the most difficult thing that you experienced in pre-production?
Oh, my. Well, I had a weird, this is a weird movie to talk about, because the movie I made before this, Casey Jones, which I think you've seen, was the most guerrilla thing I've ever made. It was all stealing shots and, you know, in alleys and, you know,
alleyway with the ninjas, man. Oh, yeah. My God. I remember I got to go on that. That was crazy.
It was all just lies and trickery and, you know, using friends. And it was just, she was like, I can make it, and all unlegit. And so this movie was supposed to be, I'm doing it the opposite. I'm doing it the legit way. I'm getting insurance. I'm hiring SAG and I'm doing all this stuff. And part of it was, and we even shot on 35 millimeter, but part of it was that was crazy, that was beyond everything, was I wanted to build a set. And I wanted to honestly block my movie and then build the set around where I wanted the camera and what I wanted in the background and the colors I wanted. So I built this kooky thing, but I didn't have money to hire people to really help me for a long time. So I was like, okay, I will build it myself for 6 months. And so every day I just lived on this, in this airport or this small airport hangar that I rented a third of. I rented like just the right side, and I'll build my set there. It took me months and months and months, but I'm doing it just by myself with clamps. So I'm clamping the wood together, screwing it. My hands start to hurt, and I don't take any days off because I know I'm not going to make my deadline. And so every day I have this existential dread of, holy shit, can I really do this by February? Can I really do this? And then the last month I'm like, oh God, I can't. And I hire a bunch of Craigslist wackos to help me, who are like, does anyone want to do some art design for like minimum wage an hour and help me? And I get just buffoons. I have to redo all their work and they don't know what they're doing. I'm wasting all this money. And then I'm like, oh no, get out. And then I hire some more other people and I get all my friends, and the movie, we come up to our deadline and I'm not done with the set, and the cast shows up and the crew shows up and the set isn't fucking done. And I'm just like, okay, we're just going to have to keep working while we shoot. I will shoot around the parts that are missing. We will work between setups. There are power tools going on. The actors are like, they have to use saws in between takes. And I'm like, yes, they do. And they're like, oh my God, what the hell's going on? Is this movie going to be good? And it's terrible for morale. But the worst thing is I'm also doing all the costume and prop stuff myself. Oh. So every night, so I work a full day on the set. And then every night I just go up to the little mezzanine and I just try and order gloves and shit online, just being like, okay, I got to find some shit. And I never got the glasses finished in time. And it's very meticulous, the weird glasses that I made for the movie. They have these fake eye spec kind of pictures in them. And they have to fit perfectly. And I'm the only one who can do it. And I didn't get to fucking do it. And so the first day of set, I just go, everybody just mill around. I have to get on my computer for 2 hours. And they're just sitting there waiting for me. And they're like, shouldn't we be filming? Everyone's getting paid to be here. And I'm like, just leave me alone. I have to do this. It's the most unprofessional, embarrassing thing ever. And everyone's really irritated with me. And it's like, what the fuck is he doing? And then so that gets finished. We shoot, we get on time. But then it comes to the green room that gets chopped up, and we haven't finished that part of the set. And I think you were there, Johnny, where I go,
I was.
We just have to shut down. Everybody build this room with me. Cast, crew, whoever wants to fucking do it. We're building a room and we're doing it right now. And so I lose half a day just building this room, and then we keep shooting, and I just stay later on the last day and do all my singles to compensate. But so I just, for 6 months, I was like, I'm not going to finish this set. I can't do it. I can't. It's not going to work. I just keep working steadily and I don't make it. It's just a nightmare, but it worked out fine.
Love it.
Sorry, it's kind of a long story, but it was.
It's entertaining. And it gives us some insight into anything can happen, because people have to realize when they get into film, especially making their own, anything can happen.
Yeah.
So many different scenarios. It's never going to work out how you think it's going to work out. It's just, you know,
you're like a mercenary coming in to make a movie and leave, and you have to build it all there and take it with you. It's not as glamorous as it sounds. Yeah.
No, not at all. For this one, I do want to open it up to the rest of the panel. I'll let Gary and Neil Riley jump in. Gary, what was the most difficult thing for pre-production that you had from either Eye of the Beholder or any of the commercials that Lead Feathers put out over the last couple of years?
Well, I think pre-production, especially if you're on a limited budget, is probably the most important part that you're going to have. of your production, because the when you're actually filming it and doing production, you know, that's when everybody's there and it's very expensive. But if you take enough time during pre-production to plan out all your shots, everything that you're going to need to be as efficient as you possibly can, that's what's really going to save you later. And it's going to save your bacon in post-production too. Because as Johnny likes to say, fix it in post. But
I hate, if you nope, don't if say it. God damn it, Gary. Do. We're not saying, nope, never say
all
that.
All the time, Johnny.
Son of a bitch. But never want to work with you again.
but if you take the time in pre-production to kind of get all those things figured out, like, you know, doing storyboarding, right. that's a great idea. Knowing who you need where, when, that's going to speed everything up, especially if you can work with other people like your DP to figure out, you know, what kind of lenses, what kind of shots you're going to need, as well as if you're writing the script yourself, take the time to write it, to draft it, to workshop it. You know, pre-production is probably my favorite part, because that's, you know, there's so much creativity and motions going on. And then when you get to production, you know, you add all the creativity of all the actors and all of the crew as well, that just kind of brings that to life. But it's in pre-production that you plant the seeds for your harvest that you're going to sow later on. And if you skip over it, or you don't do it right, or you don't take the time, then you're really gonna pay for that in, you know, production and post-production. So I think the hardest part is just, you know, trying to sit down and figure out everything that you're going to need to do and how to do it. And it seems like such a big elephant to eat. But if you just start on it and then start working a little bit at a time, like, okay, today I'm going to figure out, you know, I'm going to work on marketing and figure out, you know, when are these ads going to come out? You know, what are they going to look like? You know, how are we going to hype it up? And then, you know, you can then figure out, okay, you know, here's the script. We're going to workshop it two or three times until it's like really, really tight. Yeah. So you don't end up like some Hollywood movies that have come out lately.
I'm absolutely floored that you did not say hiring SAG actors when there's only one SAG actor to hire at the bare minimum. I am floored you didn't say that as the most difficult part of pre-production.
We kind of push that into production, which if you're going to hire SAG actors, they really want you to do that ahead of time. So they're not cool with being like, hey, I'm going to hire, Fred over here. I need him, you know, on Monday. You know, they're like, no. Give us like a month warning to just kind of prepare all of that. So if you're going to use a SAG actor, just be aware that you're going to need at least a month lead time working with SAG. And they're very nice people to work with, but they are going to need a lot of lead in time before you can start filming. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. And anytime you're dealing with a governing body of whether it's privatized or the actual government, it's always going to have a lot of red tape. There's always a lot of bureaucracy that you got to fight your way through.
Yeah, exactly.
Neil Riley, what would you say your most difficult thing with pre-production has been?
I mean, you know, honestly, all the projects that we've done together, I feel like our pre-productions have generally gone pretty smoothly because we've been fortunate enough to have each other and have a pretty good division of labor.
That's true.
I think our biggest problem is our strength, and that's the things that are slipping through the cracks. I think you're taking care of it. You think Gary's taking care of it. Gary's thinking I'll take care of it, and it doesn't get done. So communication, if you're doing this with a group of people, is the most important thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, everybody's saying so far that they've done all the pre-production for the most part by themselves or with another person. And we're like, oh, we got three people. But yeah, it's a good point. At the same time, yeah, there were tiny things that slipped through the cracks that we didn't realize needed to be addressed until on the day of production or on the day of shooting. So it's a good point. Let's move from pre-production over into production itself. So we did touch on a lot of the production aspects already, but I do want to kind of take us through the most difficult thing you experienced in production, in shooting itself, or even, you know, from the opening day to your martini time to your final shot. Let's start with Matt. Matt, what do you think the most difficult thing is for production wise for an independent filmmaker?
I think it almost boils down to just kind of forgetting about the sun. Because, you know, if it, the shot really depends, you know, because you get so caught up in going from shot to shot and like, you know, oh, we're making good time here. You know what? Let's spend a little bit more time because I have it. And you're just kind of forgetting about that. And it's something that a lot of filmmakers let go to the back of their mind. So, you know, I always get like an app that tells you where sundown is or where the sun's going to be. So you can help it line up your shots, especially if you're doing guerrilla style, you can't do it without having that.
Right. And as the director and the writer at the same time, you always want to make sure that you're getting the next shot that's perfect. And if your first two takes weren't great, you want to get a third. So do you think it's helpful to have a friend or just another coworker that is or a colleague that is working as your first AD or your UPM or your one of your producers to be there on the side, to be the kind of guy in your ear that says, hey, we got to cut it off here soon. You're paying all these people money and we don't want to go into overtime. Have you used that before or are you typically your own first AD and director at the same time?
No, you always have to have that person that can, like, you know, put it almost to you like firmly where it's like, hey man, you know, I get it, but let's get this shit moving. And it's one of those that's so, and if you don't have that, it really makes production harder because, you know, you just get so logged down. You're like, ah, crap. It's how productions get behind,
right?
You know, a production's really only as good as its AD because they really keep the flow moving. I mean, like Spielberg has an AD that he only hires if he's available because it's just, it makes the whole process that much better and allows the director to have so much more creative freedom and, but still within the realms of reality.
What kind of balls would you have as an AD to be like, sorry, Steven, I'm busy this week. Can't help you. Sorry, I just popped.
Probably some big
mind.
Ones. No, it's a good point. Probably some fucking big ones, but it is the person's job. So I feel bad for ADs, too, whenever I see them. Whenever I meet a first AD on set, and it's always the first AD, I don't know if you guys have noticed this. They always look older than they actually are. I feel like because of how stressful a first AD's job is, they always look a decade older than they actually are. If they're 25, they look 35, 40. If they're 40, they look 50 kind of thing. I don't know if anybody else has ever noticed that. I know it's a running gag or running joke.
Oh, no, totally. Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Johnny, you were first AD on Trip. You aged 5 years on that production.
That's right, man. That's right, brother. I got my first gray hair on that. You popped my cherry, man. Neil McKay, how about you, man? What was the most difficult thing for production with Trip?
I think the schedule and making the days. You know, it was a struggle to. I mean, we were trying to shoot a feature in 10 days, and we had a makeup day built in. I think we knew on like day one we're gonna need that makeup day.
Yeah.
And there was a handful of days where I was just like, oh my god, I don't know how the hell we're gonna, you know, finish this and make it happen. And I think on like day two or three, there was this crucial scene that everything in the movie takes place in a house. And there was this scene in a garage where I think I just was like, oh, I thought this was going to be simpler than it is. And it was way more complicated. And we had a visual effects shot that we didn't get to get. So we ended up having to just shelve it and like redo it on the makeup day. And that made me go, wow, we are terrible with time management on this because, you know, we're not making our days. There's no way we're going to do it. But so I think we found a rhythm like on day three or four, and then we just powered through and got through it. But yeah, I mean, you were saying, Johnny, like everything happens like at the 11th hour and it right in the nick of time. And I did feel like it happened with this. Like we were really just to get things done and make our days. It was a struggle.
Do you feel if you could go back and do Trip again or in your next foray into another feature moving forward, do you think planning the schedule, do you think you would do it again by yourself or do you think you would have somebody else do it moving forward just to take that extra workload off your plate?
It wasn't so much of the doing the schedule, more so of we just didn't have enough. We were trying to do too much.
Yeah.
With the time.
90 minutes in 3 weeks, essentially, you know, 20 something days that we got it done, but it was tight.
Yeah. I would have tried to figure out a way to build in at least 3 days or something just to have the time because we were cutting shots. Like I wish in retrospect, I think this is one of my regrets is that when we would do scenes, I should have just started with the coverage and getting like the inserts and all these various shots. And save, you know, your master wide shot for the end because it's like I barely used it in editing. So Not like I was getting a ton of those, but you know, you need like maybe one if you can, but that's one thing I guess I would have changed if I could go back.
Sure. Polaris, how about you? What was kind of the most difficult thing you've experienced in either Rec Law or any other production that you've had during the production process?
Okay. Yeah. As a director, I only do in camera editing. So like doing coverage like that, I just couldn't do it. I'm just like, I know I only want this line for this close up. I'm not filming the rest of the scene in this close up. Let's just do this line. And it saves you a little time. But my brother and I, who helped me with this movie, he was kind of my AD, but I don't really use an AD the way most people do, where they're worrying about scheduling and calling action and all that stuff. I like doing that myself on set, running the rhythms, keeping control of, you know, what shots I need to cut. I can keep it all in my head, and having somebody else to do that with me means that I have to like explain it all to them and type them out a little spreadsheet about everything. And I go, I'd much rather just keep this all in my head and just everyone trusts me. And I go, you're going to stand here. That's where your blocking is. I can't, you're not going to do that shot where you walk there until 3 days from now, but you're going to be there. Just be there, you know, and just keeping it all in my head. But what I have trouble with is all the shit outside of set. Where I had for one of my kind of B unit things, I had to do a scene in a restaurant, and Anna Tran was my AD. She's great. And she just took care of everything off set, where she goes, hey, by the way, I told everyone where to park, and I got lunch and it came here and I sat up on that table, and this guy had a problem with the noise, so I told him, and she just put out any fire that had nothing to do with making a fucking movie. And I completely neglect that shit. So I just need somebody as my right hand, you know, people to be like, hey, by the way, the flight is late. I need to go pick them up at the airport. I need to get this from the grocery store. SAG's on the phone. I'll tell them what's going on. I don't want to handle any of that shit. And I need help with that. And I could not do it without, you know, I can't do both, you know.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes we need that extra helping hand. And a lot of the best directors of all time, to your point, you look at Rodriguez, Tarantino, in particular, those guys that always talked about it. Ari Aster is not my favorite, but has talked about this in interviews before, that they don't want to take the time to explain all of these minute details to everybody because they want to get the project rolling and they'd rather just control it themselves because it's their idea. It's their thing. And they're the one that wants to bring it to life. Because, you're right. Time is our most valuable commodity. Yeah. And if we spend time kind of wasting it almost, it just
over organization. Yeah. Well, I will say that my brother and I kind of, he had made a big short that he had put all of his effort into earlier that year. And we'd been done a lot of productions. And we kind of came up with the number 14 shots where we're like, we can't, at the quality we're trying to get with, you know, getting the acting good and, you know, a shot that looks great. And, we can't do more than 14 shots a day and be happy with it. And we have to rush more than that. So we kind of locked it in at like, I'm refusing to do more than 14. And it worked. And we actually made all of our days. And the only time I went over was because I had to stop to build the set for half a day. And I had to shoot for an extra half a day. But the ratio remained intact, where it's like, we can do 14 a day with SAG rules and all that. So if you just don't overschedule. I mean, as I'm sure you all have learned to, just if you don't overschedule, then you can really make the movie you want to make, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
And absolutely build in a makeup day or two.
If you have SFX, for sure.
Yeah, because you're going to screw something up. And in the dailies, when you're looking over them, you're going to be like, oh, that's horrible. I need to redo that. And you'll feel a lot better if you have a day to do it.
That's right. Gary, what do you think the most difficult thing for production is, at least in your own, in what you've experienced?
Definitely, I think it's the coordination and getting everything to, because the production part's kind of like, when you're cooking Thanksgiving dinner and you've got like six different things on the stove and then you've got like the turkey in the oven and getting it all to come out at the same time at the right temperature, producing a movie is a lot like that because you've got things that are going to be moving at different speeds, like building the sets will move at a different speed than like capturing some B-roll or filming a scene or talking to the actors about what they're going to be trying to emote in the scene. So just being able to coordinate all that, and especially the larger the team is, the more complicated that's going to get. So you have to build in more and more time to make sure that's all working together. So, you know, when you're on a real small team and you're just, you know, like, you know, you know, one guy with a camera, and like you're keeping it all in your head, you know, and you, and if you can move like that, that's not how my mind works. So God bless you if that is, if you can do that, that's great. But, you know, if you've got a whole bunch of complicated things going on, just making sure everybody's where they need to be, when they need to be there, you know, they know what their call times are. And so like for me, having someone like you, Johnny, working on a set, cause like you get on people's ass all the fucking time about, you know, here's your call time tomorrow, make sure you're here, blah, 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 blah. And that's, not a part that I like to do. So I think that's one of the reasons you and I work well together. And Neil, like when we're on a set together, like you've got like all of these things that you're kind of going around putting out fires. So I think having a strong team is one of the really most important things that you can go into production with. And if you've done everything you can in pre-production to get all the pieces on the chessboard set up, and you have a strong team when you get into production, it's gonna be so much easier, because you're gonna run into a lot of problems, but thinking on your feet, being able to adapt to problems that happen, like, oh, it's raining today, I guess we got to film this shot inside or film it out in the rain, the Stay Hard commercial we did where was just screaming in the rain.
John Valley. Yeah.
John Valley. Yeah. When he was just screaming in the rain because it just happened to rain in the middle of the day, you know.
That was very impromptu. It was improvised. It just happened. Yeah. It was in the heat of the moment. They just told him to go do it.
And it was super dramatic. But, you know, just being able to be adaptive like that and have a team you can rely on and trust. I think that's the hardest thing to kind of get going.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement that you don't want to do everything by yourself, maybe on the creative process, but you need at least at minimum one other person to have your back for, as Polaris and Gary putting out the fires, as, you know, Neil was talking about, as for scheduling, things of that nature. So in indie film, in TV or feature films, for those of you that don't work in the industry that are listening, You have production managers, coordinators, you have a line and associate producers, you've got key PAs, you've got head of crafty, you've got all these people that are working, and it's a very intricate process, but you have all these people working in tandem to create a schedule and make sure it runs on time and is a well-oiled machine. When you don't have the money and budget for that, you've got to learn how to do it with one, two, or maybe three people. So that is certainly good advice to keep in mind moving forward. Neil Riley, what do you think the most difficult thing is for production?
I mean, during the production, I think the most difficult thing is communicating. If you're trying to do it all yourself, but you have that team, you still need to be able to delegate tasks to people. When I first started doing a lot of films, I was one of those guys who's like, I don't care if I'm getting paid. I just want to get on set. I want to learn what I can. I need to see what these people are doing. And I learned a lot about what not to do. The way certain people, it's crazy. Certain people, the way they talk to people, even though they're there voluntary, they're not getting paid, they're helping out with your project. You know, having directors who, you know, snap at you for doing what they asked you to do, but they forgot that they asked you to do it. Like, it's crazy. But I think the most difficult thing is definitely communication coming from the top down.
Yeah, for sure. So moving forward to post. Okay. So everything's filmed, the crew's feeling great. They call the martini shot. They've wrapped everything and now it's into post. Okay, and hopefully you weren't part of that group that said, we'll fix it in post or we'll edit it later, because you're just asking to shoot yourself in the foot.
Johnny.
Let's start. Yeah. Okay, in all fairness, you're the one that always says that. I fucking hate you. I wish I had a recording of every time we were on set. Anyways, Matt, let's start with you. What's the most difficult thing you've experienced in post in the past, or the most difficult thing in post that you find on your everyday individual shoots?
I think the most difficult thing is indecision, because you just need the conviction, especially with the cut, because, you know, there's certain things about individual scenes that you shot. You're going to be like, oh, you know, this was shot 3 on the second scene, or, you know, like, oh, you think about it like that and you kind of build a little bit of an attachment and you just kind of need that, like, push through. And, you know, I struggle with that a little bit in with my one I shot with Angus detached, because it just, I had so many shots and I was cutting it down for time, and I was just trying to find what I loved about each scene that helped move the story forward. And so it's just approaching it with the next scene, but like getting just coming in early, leaving late kind of thing.
Yeah. Polaris, jump to you. What was the most difficult thing you experienced in post with either Casey Jones, sure, but Reclon in particular? And I ask you specifically because you were filming on, you say 35 millimeter you were filming on?
Yes. Okay. So my post was fucked. I was completely broke when we stopped shooting. I'd called in all my favors and all the money I could get, barely finished. And was completely broke. And so I don't even have the money to develop my film. So I buy a deep freeze, keep it at my sister's house, and I just put all the cans in there. It takes an entire year before I save up enough money and pay off other debts that come up to develop this. I get the film back and some of it's messed up. And so a few shots are red cast where two of the channels didn't, I don't know, expose. I don't know why. I don't know if it was a light leak or bad film or whatever. There's also a lot of chewed up sections. I use short ends and recans, which means that, you know, anyone who doesn't know that who's listening, if you're shooting on a bigger production budget and using fresh film, if you don't use the whole roll, you'll just cut it and resell the remains. So if you're shooting 6 minutes of film and you know, maybe sell 2 or 3 minutes you didn't use. So it's already been in and out of the magazine and stuff a few times, and it collects a little dust every time. Sometimes it gets crinkly, you know. And so a lot of my film is kind of rough looking and needs some love to me to Photoshop out all the dust and scratches.
Right.
But then even worse, we had a mechanical malfunction in the camera. So I tipped the camera. I tried a shot. We didn't even use it because I couldn't get it to work. We tried a shot where I tipped the camera on its right side. In the magazine, it has the film is up against the left side and it's open on the right. So it unspooled a little inside. And so that magazine came out a little crooked. And so the film was crinkled. And so I just have this fucked up crinkly thing and I have to fix that and, you know, try and find a way to grain reduce that. And then on top of all that, I use this experimental kind of thing called a cinefade, which is a variable ND attached to an iris, and they go in tandem together so you can kind of rack the depth of field. But the variable ND, we thought we compensated with exposure, but not enough. So some of my shots were extra fucking dark and you could barely get an image out of them. So I have this really just mess. Some of it's good. A lot of it looks good, but I have a lot of messed up shots. And I can't afford a colorist who can spend the amount of time it would take to figure out how to fix this. So right. I have to learn to be a colorist. So for like 6 weeks, I'm just watching YouTube and being like, okay, how did you do that? And I think I have my system, and then I have to recolor half the movie again. I go, no, I should have put that note in front of that note, fuck. And I recolored about 4 times the entire movie. Up until we released it. So that was my problem, is trying to fix this fucking footage. And people watch it and go, oh, I don't even know what you're talking about. It looks fine. And I go, well, I really worked hard to fix it. So anyways, film, I don't want to scare people from using it, but I have more confidence now using it, knowing what not to do, but also that it can all be fixed. You can figure it out.
That's right. So going back and doing it again or future projects, would you film on the 35 millimeter again?
Absolutely. I don't want to shoot on anything again else. Like I'm hooked now because we had permanent lighting setups. You know, I wasn't working with the most experienced cinematographer in the world, and I was helping him, you know, with half the responsibilities and, you know, just my basic kind of costuming and set stuff. And it looks fucking like, I'll just pause on an image while I'm working on it. I go, this looks fucking great. So even if you don't know what you're doing that much, just exposing a piece of 35 millimeter looks like a movie. You know, it looks like what I always wanted my movies to look like. And if I can figure out how to do it again, I will.
Okay. Okay. Neil McKay, how about you? What was the most difficult thing that you had in post with Trip?
I've never had a problem with post production ever, so I don't know what you're talking about.
I'm sure, man.
No horror stories here. there's inevitably always something like that, some scene, and you're just like, oh my god, what's going on here. We had a issue with a tripod where it was like real herky jerky in this one particular scene, and then the window was overexposed, and then the colors wouldn't match, so it was kind of a nightmare to edit just to get things to match and get a shot that's not herky jerky. Also, we were shooting a little bit more guerrilla style than I would have liked, you know, just trying to make these days and everything. So we kind of sped through some stuff that in retrospect, I wish we took more time to do. Like there's one particular scene that happens later in the movie where it's kind of a reveal, but it just looks kind of silly because this thing just happens and there's no like effect or anything. And it was originally supposed to be like an in-camera lighting effect where like the lights would shut off. Uh-huh. And we just didn't have time or we couldn't do it. So in a way, it was kind of a blessing in disguise because I didn't really realize what you could do with digital visual effects nowadays. So I had a VFX artist on who kind of we were going back and forth and she did some cool stuff. And it was like she just did it all in post. We fixed it in post, so to speak. So and there were some other practical effects with like makeup and stuff that didn't quite look right. So you can clean some of that stuff up and the digital effects, what like Polaris was doing with like fixing these, these shots, just get that out of there. I had some like boom shots removed, boom popping in the shot, or like boom shadow. You can get rid of that stuff, like a Photoshop thing. So I was pretty amazed with like what you could do and what people are willing to do for, kind of quote unquote friend prices. So, just kind of, I think when you see what you have and you're like, it's not quite what I wanted it to be. And what do you do? And kind of, how do you fix it? And how out of the box can you get with recutting the scene or what have you?
Yeah. So, As much as collectively we may not think that post or production or pre-pro are the most difficult aspects of the film, I personally would say that finding the financing and then distribution, the festival circuit, I feel that those would be the most difficult. Getting your movie seen, that's the most difficult part. That's the most challenging area.
It's the part you have the least control over. That's right. What's so awful about it.
Yeah, and so Polaris, we'll start with you since you're currently on the festival circuit right now and you're moving around. So you found success with South By and then a bunch of other festivals across the country. What has been your route that you're going to take? Are you going festival and then partnering with a distribution company, or are you trying to get seen at the festivals and hoping something works out? What's your process?
So I've been noticing with these bigger festivals that the people that you want to meet, the distributors, the head of Paramount or whatever, they're not there. you can't find them. They're not going and watching 8 days of movies. Right. But so for me, what is important about those is kind of a stamp of approval that if I do hire, so a shopping agent, which we do have one now, somebody who's shopping it around to get the feature made, but it helps them if they can put a good festival, Sundance Film wins, blah, 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 in just a subject line or, on the phone. So having these stamps of approval that you've been in a festival will get you open the door for you where you can contact these people and they might watch it. If I was working as the head of Paramount and somebody was like, hey, you want to check out this script or this movie? I'd be like, who represents him? Who's in it? Have they won anything? Does this guy have a Pulitzer? Have I heard of them? I would need some sort of assurance that I'm not wasting my time with a jack-off. And right. So all these things are systems of approval for that. And even a casting director, if you're looking for movie stars, it's like, okay, this casting director I know read this script and is willing to trouble me with it and thinks it's worth my time. So that does help. But I think I'll have to keep collecting shopping agents and sure. executive producers and people to just try and get their tentacles out there. To try and get something. There are people who that's all they do is they meet people and they keep contacts and they keep in touch and they collect the films and the projects and they call them their own, but they're really just like, I'm part of that now, where Continuance Pictures is like, we represent you as your executive producer. And they go, well, these are all the festivals that all our other people got into. We can email them and say, hey, our other short film, High Tension, whatever, got into your thing. Can I get a waiver for rec law? And it's like you're joining a little group. And that helps you get in. And every time they have a short film or a pilot or something, they meet more people and they just collect these contacts. So a festival can help you get in line with somebody like that. And they're kind of a middle step to getting a meeting and maybe pitching.
Okay, so kind of just playing the field and seeing what happens. You want to try to collect as many accolades as possible to improve your resume. for a future executive.
And I will also say I'll get into some big festivals like South by and Fantasia and then get rejected by, you know, North Louisville Indie Underground Festival. And I'm like, what the fuck? It's somewhat unpredictable where I just go, I can't guarantee in anything. So you do have to cast kind of a wide net with your submissions.
Yeah. Yeah. Neil McKay, we go to you really quick. I know you had originally spoken with me and asked if I knew anybody at like Shudder or Sci-Fi Network or anything like that. So have you been talking to distribution companies moving forward kind of thing? Have you looked at the festival route? Where are you at?
Yeah, so I did get a distribution company. They're called Terror Films, so they specialize in horror movies. Cool. Like I said, so that's official. That's a done deal. They're awesome. I'm in their queue. They're releasing at the beginning of 2022, and I just happen to know the head of acquisitions over there because we in another lifetime ago worked on a movie like 20 years ago. And it's just a coincidence because I heard the president of the company was on like a podcast talking about, I don't know if you guys are familiar with this debacle. It's Distributor, which was like they were like a middleman to get you on a platform like, you know, a Hulu or something like that. And they were doing some shady business practices and basically just went belly up. And then all these movies are like stuck in limbo, you know, because the filmmakers don't really own them because this company owns them. Anyway, I'm sure you could look it up and find a bunch of information on it. But this guy, Joe Dane, was talking about that on a podcast podcast. And he just what he was saying about what they were doing to represent the filmmaker just sounded pretty good. And I just, because I knew an old friend there, you know, I was like, okay, I'm pretty sure they're reputable. And they do a lot of things like they'll get your movie reviewed and they'll put it out there and they have some money baked in for marketing. So there was a lot of things that they'll get you on different platforms, like, you know, your AVOD advertising on demand. They'll get you on the subscription based kind of thing. So and they keep, you know, pushing it out there. So it seemed like a good deal. It seems like they, you know, they'll do a lot of things that I can't do because I mean, there's only so many people on Facebook that I can, you know, be like, hey, watch my movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like, right. But I did try, you know, my producing partner, David Groves, he told me that the festival circuit would be a waste of time. And I think he was right. I haven't gotten into any. I think it's because it's a feature. Like, I don't know the math of like how many, you know, I mean, they have obviously less features than shorts. And it's just a completely different animal, I feel like, because just based on what they select. And I've just never really had much luck with festivals, but I thought, hey, you know, go ahead and try it. But I think I was I'm in competition with like all the 2020 and 2021 movies because of COVID, because no, really everything was virtual last year. So people maybe like sat on a movie.
Right.
So I would submit to something. And then like a day after, like all of a sudden they have like their first wave of movies that they're like, and it's like, they've already selected these and I just submitted. And it's like, are they even looking at my movie? You know? So I don't know. It's, and I think to like kind of what Polaris was saying is like, I don't know if you're going to just walk into a festival and get distribution or, you know, get a sales agent or any of that stuff. So it's really a crapshoot. I mean, you might as well just get the thing out there and get, you know, build an audience or get some, you know, try to and get some word of mouth or something. That's kind of my thought on it.
Was this one of those things where when I was with the production company I was with before this, Bad Hero, we had actually taken a feature and we had given it to a group called Buffalo 8, I think is what they were called, based out of LA, and they were a distribution company. And we paid them to take it and get it on different platforms. And it made a little bit, but not really. It didn't really make a ton of waves. Was this one of those things where did you hire these guys or did they find you and they're like, hey, we'll take you on and we'll take a percentage off the back end?
I found them and then we talked and then so there was no money up front. Like, they're basically like, all right, we're gonna do all this stuff. You know, they pay for, they work with you on like the poster and stuff if you need help with that, and all of the marketing tools and all these things. And they just do all of that. They got a money baked in to do that. And then, but the deal is like, you know, they take, whatever, 40% or whatever it is, of anything, you know, you make. And,
Right.
Which isn't the greatest deal, because usually you're kind of more an 80-20.
But at least you get it out there.
Yeah. I think, like, what's the other big one? Like, David used blanking on it, but Indie Rights, and they do like an 80-20 split, but Indie Rights doesn't do anything for you. They just put it on a platform. Like, well, I mean, you could do that yourself. You could get a movie on Amazon without a distribution company.
Right.
So I felt like Terror Films was going to do more for the movies first, getting it out there. Because if it's on a platform, great. Nobody knows about it. You know, it's like buried in the pile of, you know, stuff. And there's a lot of stuff on Amazon. I mean, there's just a sea of indie movies.
Crap, we're never going to hear about or see.
How do you even know, like, what's good? And, you know, so the percentages weren't the greatest, but I felt like what I'm getting is better than what I would get with a more favorable deal. And something like Shudder, I think they can get it on Shudder, Amazon, all of these things. So Tubi is like apparently like a good move now. If you have a movie ready for distribution, it's like a commercial, like free TV with commercials. I've been hearing a lot of people like that. And there's another one like Pluto, which are these. And people of like, you can actually make money using those.
I just watched a really horrible horror movie called Swamp Zombies 2 on my buddy Ian Webb's podcast, Movie So Bad They're Good. And we were reviewing that film, and it's made some waves, but it was on Pluto, and it was hilarious. It was a great little
It sounds awesome. Film. I mean,
don't give up on the series. Swamp Zombies 3 is good. It turns around. Right.
Now there wasn't a Swamp Zombies 1, so it makes lead me to believe that that it was made up on that portion. But Matt, how about you? Have you had any experience with? I know you said with your short, you didn't. You said you went the festival route, but you didn't go any type of distribution to try and get a feature made. What experience have you had with the distribution and festival circuits?
You know, I was using a lot of Film Freeway is a great one for the indie.
Oh, yeah.
There.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's the best way to get your script and or movie out to a variety of, and, you know, you can search them down and figure out what, you know, like I want a screenplay one or, you know, a feature.
A lot of free ones too. You can find a lot of free ones on there. If you don't mind going to a smaller festival.
And, you know, you never know who's watching. And I think that's the beauty of it all as well. Mm-hmm. Cause you know, just one person says the right thing to one another, you know, it gets going, but distribution is not something I've dealt with a lot in my career, to be honest, because it's just one of those. I'm on getting hired onto different productions and then, you know, grabbing what I can, like with the Betsy thing, just kind of picking up and moving forward to the next production.
Sure. All right, guys. Well, I've just had such a great conversation with you guys today. Super insightful. Anybody who has wanted to jump into filmmaking and bringing their own projects to life and breathing life into them will certainly benefit from listening to the insight from the three of you guys, and hopefully from some of the less insightful things that the three hosts had. Just kidding, guys. I love everybody. we are basically out of time here. We're trying not to go over the 2-hour mark. So before we go, we do let our panel and our hosts give recommendations to our listeners for the week on a movie or two that they might want to have them watch, maybe one they haven't heard of. Preferably this week, we wanted to take a look at the greatest indie films of all time. So I'm going to let everybody take a second. If you haven't looked one up, by all means, Google it really quick. Or if you have one in your head. Perfect. We'll go ahead and start with the hosts just to give our guests a second to kind of get their thoughts together since they've been speaking so much and they might want to get a second to check out some lists. I'm going to start. I'm going to go ahead and for this week, I'm going to go on ahead and bring up Requiem for a Dream. Requiem for a Dream was one of my first forays into kind of the existential indie film circuit, I guess. Saw it when I was really stoned my freshman year at conservatory in Waco, but really enjoyed it. It was one of those movies that, to the point after seeing Jared Leto in it, I just kind of became obsessed with everything that he did, with the exception of the most recent Suicide Squad, or the one before that. It's certainly a movie that is a tough and kind of often an ugly film, but completely true. It speaks to the horrors of addiction, whether it be to addiction to TV, addiction to hardcore drugs, addiction to opioids and prescription pills, anything like that. If you're interested in checking out a movie that's, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, look into the world of addiction. A lot of societal culture commentary on there, and really thoroughly enjoyed it. Still to this day, one of my favorite existential indie films. So Requiem for a Dream. Neil Riley, let's jump to you. What would you recommend for our listeners for the week?
I mean, if we're talking about top indie films, I would have to put at the top of my list Reservoir Dogs, Quentin Tarantino.
Oh, hell yeah. Any Tarantino.
Classic film.
Absolutely.
Just well shot. Soundtrack is great. Just the audio in it in general is amazing. Just all around fantastic film.
Fantastic. Any Tarantino is always going to be, gonna be fantastic. Obviously. But yeah, Reservoir Dogs in particular. And if you haven't listened yet, we did a full panel episode on Quentin Tarantino at the beginning of season two. So go ahead back on and check that out somewhere in the 25 to 35 range. I can't remember the exact episode number. Either way, Gary, how about you? What are you recommending this week?
Well, for independent films, I think, you've got to look at the Blair Witch Project.
Definitely.
It may not have been like the greatest film ever made. And more so than the amount of money that it made for the cost of it, which I believe still sets the record for percentage. But it was a cultural phenomenon. It changed how movies were filmed in a big way, you know, in the same way like The Matrix did. And everybody knew it, and a lot of people saw it. And what was so cool about it was that it was all just word of mouth. Like, people heard about it, and so they started to go see it. And then it kind of just built this following over a long time. And it was just done on a real shoestring budget. I think it was $60,000 back in 99 or so.
99, yeah. Just making up all those ads. They made up the newspaper ads, the obituaries and stuff of these kids disappearing, and they were just completely falsified. None of these people actually existed. It was a great marketing ploy. The movie, for sure.
Absolutely. And just really, really iconic for an independent film, I think.
I was working at a movie theater when that came out, and it wasn't big time yet. It was just playing at the little indie movie houses, and people were calling the theater like, "Oh my God, is this thing real? Are you guys showing this? Is it a documentary? What is this thing?" And
it's insane. The Blair Witch Project is old enough to have graduated college now. So
that'll
make us all feel old.
Damn it, Gary. Jesus. Matt, how about you? What do you recommend indie wise for our viewers this week?
I'm going to go with a classic, you know, one that's very loved. This is Spinal Tap.
This one goes to 11.
Fantastic. And it just made mockumentary more mainstream in a sense. And, you know, there's a lot of that coming out now, and you can definitely attribute it to This is Spinal Tap.
Anything with Christopher Guest really is going to be great.
Yeah. Yeah. Best in Show, still my favorite, but another good one. Always solid. Neil McKay, how about you?
Yeah, a lot of great recommendations so far. So I don't know if it's the best indie movie, but I'm going to go with it just because it's one of my favorites of all time. Yeah. But Swingers.
Yeah.
So
your money, baby, your money.
Yeah. I mean, there's just so many classic lines. It was such a great story. I just love the kind of 180 of the two main characters at the end. And it just kind of was like a buddy movie. And it was just cool. And I know I just saw behind the scenes stuff of how they did it. And it was such a shoestring budget. And I mean, at the time, I mean, John Favreau, Vince Vaughn, Doug Liman, they were all Heather Graham, I think, nobody knew any of those people. So it's just kind of a nostalgia ride for me for that one.
For sure. Polaris, how about you?
I'd like to disagree. These are all terrible choices. I'm disappointed in all of them. Now, I saw recently, I think an indie film, it's got to be doing a lot with what it has. You know, it's got to be doing more with less for it to be like really the indie film spirit. And I saw Texas Chainsaw Massacre for the first time a month ago, and I was like, this is fucking... Yeah, I was like, this is fucking great. And he did so much and reinvented the genre with just sound design and ideas and great acting and crazy editing. And I was like, this guy wrung every fucking bit of awesome out of the little he had. So I was really impressed with that.
Perfect, man. So guys, fantastic recommendations once again. So we can't thank the three of you enough for coming on. Really quick, do want to ask before we go, when your films come out, where can our viewers catch them? Do you guys have a social media presence if people want to follow you? Anything like that? Matt, let's start with you. I know you've currently got your docu series or your documentary special coming out. Is there anywhere people can follow you, or should they just be on the lookout for the story of the Black Amelia Earhart coming soon?
So I'm actually going to try to make a feature of that, and so
gotcha.
Yeah, right now you could follow me on Instagram at matt.sj.18.
Perfect. Okay, and we'll make sure to add those names below in the description on Spotify, Apple, Google, Pandora, and all of our other podcast hosting sites. Neil McKay, when can we expect, do we have an exact release date for Trip to come out? And is there any particular streaming service we should be looking for on it? Any social media platform you'd like our listeners to follow you on?
It's not out. I don't have a date yet. Not out yet. I'm pretty sure it's going to be on something like Tubi or Amazon Prime. I'd bet money on that. There's going to be a multiple, a bunch of platforms, but, my Instagram handle's neil.mckay. So that's neil.mckay. That's me on Instagram. I'll be posting stuff, I'm sure, on there. And then we also, me and Dave Groves, have a podcast for 611 Films.
That's right.
If you just Google 611 Films or 611 Films, it should come up on Apple or Spotify or whatever. And so we got a bunch of stuff there. And we're actually going to be having some podcasts with like the cast and crew of Trip when it's closer to the release date. So,
yeah, I know you guys had me on about 2 months ago to record one for future episodes. Yep. So everybody, please. Yeah. Everybody make sure to check out 611 Films podcast as well. And Polaris, last but not least, how about yourself?
I mean, we'll put Reklon on a streamer one day when it's done,
That's right.
Doing this festival crap. But I don't know what it's going to be. So just follow Reklon Movie on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook, and I'll let you know.
Fantastic. Fantastic. And for all of those listening, we will go ahead and definitely provide updates whenever these guys have released their newest projects. So you can go ahead and follow them and continue to support indie filmmakers. And hopefully we all make it big and prosperous one day together. That's the dream, huh? Anyway, so once again, Polaris, Neil, and Matt, thank you guys so much for joining us. It was an absolute pleasure having you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, and for all of us here at I Don't Give a Flick, I'm Johnny.
I'm Gary.
And I'm Neil Riley. Yep.
Y'all stay classy. We'll see you next week.
Thank you for tuning in to Leadfeather Productions' podcast of I Don't Give a Flick. Make sure to subscribe to our podcast so that you never miss an episode. Podcasts are available on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube, and everywhere podcasts are hosted. I Don't Give a Flick is hosted and produced by Johnny Blackburn, Gary Elmore, and Neil Riley. Executive producer Johnny Blackburn, technical director, editor, and audio mixer Gary Elmore. I Don't Give a Flick is a Leadfeather production, copyright Leadfeather Productions 2021.